First, I'd like to recognize our co-authors, of course, Dr. Danil, Dr. Reen Scoresby, and Jerry Darlington from Minerals Technologies, and Chad Calloway from AgLogic, LLC. The research that I'm going to present to you was done with two different humic products from two different companies, one of them being the Intersol product that Dr. Reen Scoresby just talked about, and also the Yield Igniter humic product from AgLogic. So Dr. Olk and I are working on right now a literature review of field studies of humic products, and in that process I've gathered over 50 papers so far. There seems to be a pretty good consensus on research results documenting fairly consistent yield increases. Of course, that varies dramatically in warm, arid environments with many crops. But one of the issues that is lacking from a lot of those studies is looking at the variability in those responses across differing soils and landscapes. And when you think about that, then, how would these sources of variability influence agronomic recommendations to farmers for the humic companies? That's one of the first things that farmers are always going to pick up on. It says, how is this going to work with my soils, my crops, my climate? So on some of the very important sources of variability that if you look at the theories of how the humic products would work, these are the ones that stand out to us that are probably huge factors. First of all, time, that being weather patterns, drought versus so-called ideal for whatever that crop is versus wet conditions. In wet, super wet conditions, I don't know if there's anything that's going to help that when the soil goes anaerobic. Unless you got rice, you're in trouble. But the other things dominate what the weather patterns are across most agricultural areas. Space is another huge one. Landscape position, and related to that in most areas of the world, it's the soil organic matter content, and I'd also add to that the water relations. In some of the data Reen showed and what I'm going to show here in a little bit, those I think stand out very well. And another thing that I hope someday we will get to is the very important part of what the farmer's doing himself or herself in their operation. You talk, about determinants of yield. You got the genetic factor, you got the environmental factor, and that's where a lot of people stop because for some reason a lot of people don't want to acknowledge the agronomics, but there's the management factor too. And as we see in the data, particularly like what Dr. Reen Scoresby just showed a little while ago, we can hit a genetic potential if the conditions are really good. There is nothing limiting. And if the management was really good, it helps it keep that genetic potential. It's only during stress when you can improve on that. So our research questions that we addressed was for us, particularly, we're in a humid, mostly humid anyway, rain-fed conditions in the Midwest with very high organic matter soils. And you look at the theory of the humic products and what they can do, if you wonder how effective are these going to be with increasing yield in our area, because in theory we'd be one of the most difficult places to be able to get a crop grain yield response. And if we do get a response, what aspects of growth are going to be affected by the humic substances for both corn and soybean? And then, looking at the variability with the different fields and the experiments we've got out there. So we have a few different research approaches. For the first one, we did a field extensive survey over a three-year time period from 2009 to 2011. And this was kind of almost like a meta-analysis type thing where we did pair comparisons of control versus treated and took our samples within those. It covered 95 site years, most of them in Iowa, a few in Nebraska, and that was for corn only. Our second approach was to do multiple field intensive experiments where we did strip plot replications, put their treatments across there, and we were very picky about which fields we did that in. We wanted to make sure, and we did, that when we went out there, that we had the same soils across all of the treatment strips. that gave us the power to be able to take not just our, you know, hand sample data, but also the combined grain yield georeferenced data, and then separate that by soil type. And in all of those experiments, for the intensive experiments, they had a minimum of 4 replications. On the field, corn and soybean yield components, we'd measured those for every experiment, and then, of course, utilizing the combine and hand sample data for both yields. Now, these are a list of a lot of the measures that we did for corn. We did parameters for growth, nutrients, in-season tissue, both nutrients and hormones and antioxidants, depending on the field. Of course, looking at the grain and stover yields, looking at grain quality with the protein, oil, and starch, 100 kernel weights, and, of course, as always, the soil samples for nutrients, organic matter, and pH. Now, this is the field that you would see that Dr. Reen Scoresby showed a little bit here ago in his presentation. So in the foreground is that eroded upland soil, clarion soil type with about 3.5% organic matter. This field's been tilled for over 100 years, and in places it, you know, had probably about 18 to 24 inches of nice topsoil. Now it's down to some areas to the sand, subsoil. On the side slope, that's considered in our area that hot soil that always seems to produce really well with a 5.5% organic matter. And then the background is the lowland or the Webster soil type with 6.5 for soil organic matter. This site was researched in years 2012, 14, and 16 for corn. The measures that we did for soybean, again, parameters for growth, grain, and soil, and not 100 kernel weight, but 100 grain weight and grain quality. On the grain yield, Dr. Reed showed this a little bit ago. This is in 2012 during that very severe drought year. And as you see in the percentages there, moving from left to right, on the upland soil with the 3.5% organic matter, which a lot of places in the world would still kill for, we had in that drought year about 30 to 40% increase in grain yield. On that very productive soil where water relations and organic matter seems to be ideal for crop production, that increase diminished down to about 2 to 3%. And then we had in the lowlands, probably because of relationship there with a little bit of too wet to begin with at the very beginning of that year, between 6 to almost 14% grain yield increase. Now, soil type effect, you know, that shouldn't surprise anyone when you see a graph like this. The soil type or landscape position effect was very significant. And we had also a highly significant response of the humic product for grain yield. Exact same field, exact same measuring areas out there for the different reps. Ideal conditions in 2014. The rain was sparsed out just perfect to get great grain yields. Moving from left to right again across those different landscape positions and organic matter contents, we had still about a 5 to 8% yield increase, but it was pretty much a wash across the two higher organic matter locations. Soil type effect, there was none. Very not insignificant under ideal conditions and not a significant effect of the humic product under those ideal conditions. Now, this is a graph of all of the 95 pairings over the 3 years for that field extensive sampling and survey that we did. Now, this, and in our discussions with Reen, Scoresby, and other people too, this seems to mirror what they've seen in potatoes and a lot of other crops. When you get a whole lot of samples, it gives you the ability to graph these things out and see relationships like this. So on overall, across all those 95 pairings, we had a 6.5% increase in grain yield, statistically highly significant, 0.001. What's very interesting about this too is the distribution shift. You see fewer incidences of the lower yields on that left side of that graph, and it kind of shifts everything to the right. As Reen Scoresby has said with his potato research, it seems to bring up the weak ones and bring them up to more normal conditions. And for potatoes, that's very valuable when you're increasing the quality of it. Oh, and just quickly, and over those 3 years, we had a 70 to 80% incidence of numeric grain yield increases. On the corn leaf area, of course, this is an indicator of the growing conditions the plant is experiencing at the time of formation of those leaves. And, of course, it also provides the engine for plant growth. In that severe drought year, if we look at the two different Entersol rates that we put out there compared to the control, we had about a 4 to 5.5% increase in leaf area and probability of about 0.12 for the lower rate, but significant at 0.04 for the higher rate. On cob length, I'm not going to dwell on this too much because Reen already showed those data a little bit ago, but in the severe drought year, we didn't have a landscape effect on that or soil type effect, but with the humic product, if you consider a 0.1 as being significant, which has been doing field research for 25 years now, 0.05 I think is crazy, obsessive compulsive to hold that to that level, and it drives us nuts, particularly if they just say, well, if it doesn't make 0.05, it doesn't work. That's not reality. And when you talk to farmers, they'll say, hey, if this stuff works 70, 75% of the time, economically for me, I'm going to look at this stuff. So 0.1, that's still pretty good. Under ideal conditions, you can see we didn't have much of an effect on the cob length. No landscape effect and 0.29 on the humic product. Interestingly here, again, this is from that field extensive survey over 3 years and those 95 pairings. It mirrors so much the grain yield. So you've got about a 3% increase in the cob length across all of those samples. And what I find also really cool about this is if you do the averages here, how wide is a kernel? It's about 0.4 centimeters. So if you look at our increase in cob length and you think back to what we got for yield increase, they correlate extremely well. So that cob length was grain filled. Now, we've got 8 years of research with all kinds of stuff. I don't have the time to dig in and do a bunch, so I'm showing you today just some examples, fair examples of what's going on here. So 2013, Reen presented this a little bit ago too. The first half of the season was really wet, second half was dry, which is bad for farming. But on our soybean yields, we had 0.20 and 0.05 statistical significance for the grain yields. On those pod counts for the very same fields and samples, interestingly, our pod counts much bigger increases than we did on the grain yield. So obviously not all of those pods got filled. And there was more variability with that, but if you understand, indeterminate soybeans, it's a wild, funky plant in that, and it just lends itself to those kinds of variability a little bit more, but still significant to close significance on both of those. Now, for Iowa, for our research that we did in our conditions, we have so far no statistical or numeric differences with all of these different measures. The 100 kernel weight, 100 grain weight, grain quality, and the soil measures so far, nothing on those. So looking back to our, three original research questions, answering those, after 8 years, can humic substances improve crop production in what is probably the most difficult place to try to get a humic effect on crop yield and growth? Numerically, yes. Our extensive survey gave us about a 70 to 80% increase in yields. Statistically, at times, yes, significant at both 0.1 and 0.05 levels under certain conditions. On what aspects of crop growth, then, did these tend to increase? On corn, we had even in years when we don't have grain yield increase, we almost always have leaf area increase, which shows it is biologically active, it's doing something. As Reem pointed out, and we've seen this as we've been tracking with our measures throughout the years, is you'll go ahead and you'll have just like, wow, this crop looks so much better with the humic compared to the controls all along the way. But because corn can rob from its body, from the stalk, to fill those grains, and it will and does, we've seen that the control catches up then during the grain fill period a little bit. So you don't get that dramatic difference that you thought you would have got from all season long. But because we take the stover samples, that gives us the evidence of where that came from. And as Reen showed, it did. That's where the catch-up for the controls came from. Ear length and grain yield, we typically have increases in those. Soybean, it's the seed-filled pods and the grain yield. On that third question, how do these things vary? Well, as we've seen, landscape location, it's from our research, particularly with that one field with the Bob Finch, it suggests that there are landscape or soil organic matter influences on how much the humic substance can benefit the farmer. And definitely, weather patterns from this presentation and Dr. Reen's, that's very much a factor with the efficacy of humic products. It is not going to produce the same effects every year. The gains seem to be better in those drought conditions compared to no water stress, and the lesser organic matter soils are rougher texture soils compared to the higher organic matters. On some more conclusions here, then for Iowa, in the rain-fed conditions with high organic matter levels, we don't see increases in quality so much, but quantity. Given all of those high organic matter level soils, it's probably going to take several years or maybe many years before we can see any differences in soil parameters. In other regions with lesser organic matter contents that have more incidence of drought in different crops, I think it's reasonable to assume that those effects are going to be different. There's going to be a greater incidence of improvements with the crop with the humics. And a very important thing on this, and this is not just our studies, but those from our literature reviews, is that a lot of times the increase in grain or crop production is 10% or less. So to be able to measure that, you got to do a very good job on your site selection, your research design, and your management. Otherwise, you're going to introduce so much variability, you're going to lose the ability to see those differences. And interestingly, too, during those 8 years of research, there's other things that agronomic research can do a lot to improve the marketability of humic products. You see, we had a windstorm that flattened the corn in 2012 during that drought in the untreated border. And at the first row of our humic product with the Enersol, it stood like a, well, maybe not an oak forest, but it did a whole lot better. It stayed up. And then we see incidences repeatedly of less fungal disease infection into the crops. And if you've been to any of the other presentations around here, particularly on the scarcity and the resilience and all that other stuff, it's obvious global population is supposed to increase to 9 billion by about 2050, they project. And that's just going to put a whole lot more pressure on the marginal soils to be able to produce more food. All the arable soil is already taken. It's being used. And we see that the humic products can be an extremely effective tool and relatively low cost for helping overcoming these challenges. And in the future, some more agronomic research where we can do things to improve things. We can maybe document improvements for irrigation, fertilizer inputs, and water quality, soil health, and also reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay. Thank you, Dana.